Hello, and welcome to Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll continue reading articles from the August 2025 issue. Up first is a report titled, Playing Dead, Do the Democrats Really Want Reform? By Andrew Cockburn, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. On April 25th, the same day that FBI agents arrested a Wisconsin judge and ICE deported a cancer-stricken 4-year-old U.S. citizen to Honduras, I arrived in Grand Island, a city of some 50,000 in the heart of rural Nebraska, for a people's town hall. It was part of a series of such events promoted by the National Democratic Party to channel grassroots outrage over the Trump administration's unbridled assaults on the fabric of American government, an outrage most forcefully demonstrated by the massive crowds turning out for the Fighting Oligarchy rallies, which started in Nebraska, assembled by Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, congressional Republicans who had experienced an unwelcome taste of popular discontent at their own formerly placid town halls, were now under orders from party headquarters to avoid such encounters. If they won't talk to their own voters, then Democrats will, announced Ken Martin, the newly installed chair of the Democratic National Committee. That's why we'll be hosting people's town halls in all 50 states across the country, starting now with vulnerable GOP-held target districts. Grand Island, for its part, hardly qualifies as vulnerable. It sits in Nebraska's vast 3rd Congressional District, where the Republican representative, Adrian Smith, was reelected for a 10th term in 2024 with just over 80% of the vote. But like most of his peers, he had largely been shirking meetings where he was likely to face protest. The DNC venue, festooned with placards proclaiming benefits before billionaires, was packed to capacity with more than 300 people. Most, but not all, were Democrats. I didn't know there was a Democratic Party in Nebraska. I'm an independent, a man in the line for the ample buffet said loudly. We should be on the streets, shouted an elderly gentleman bearing a striking resemblance to Sanders. Debbie Thompson, a retired English professor, had jettisoned her post-retirement plan to write a history of plastics, and the day after the election, had connected with her local county Democratic Party. I went to a meeting because I thought, I can't do this alone. I want to do something, she told me. As with many of those stirred to action by Trump's return, her activism was not confined to party-led organizations. She had also set up a local branch of Indivisible, the progressive group born in the days of Trump 1.0 that, along with Sanders, has been mobilizing protests this time around. She was now helping lead regular demonstrations in her hometown of Hastings, 25 miles away. The day before the town hall, the Nebraska Republican Senator, Pete Ricketts, a multimillionaire whose family owns the Chicago Cubs, had ventured to hold a town hall in Kearney, home to a campus of the University of Nebraska, a rare exception to his party's policy of lying low. Thompson had gone along with her friend Joyce Moore, a retired elementary school teacher. Ricketts, she told me, had been dismissive of voters who peppered him with questions about the so-called Department of Government Efficiency's cuts to services and threats to benefits. Folks from South Central Nebraska were asking Ricketts important questions, and his replies were, in essence, either that we were wrong or that we should just trust Congress and the president, she said. Moore, the vice chair of the local Democratic Party in nearby Adams County, recalled feeling politically isolated when she moved to the state 6 years ago. People in Nebraska just fall into being Republican, she said. The Democrats, in her experience, had been involved in state politics and things, but there wasn't the motivation, fear, anger, the emotions she felt were now spreading across the state. A protest that she and Thompson had helped organize in Hastings the previous week had attracted 75 people, despite its being Easter weekend. We had people from little towns all around us, Thompson told me, driven by angst over Trump's tariffs, threats to the state's agricultural exports, and looming Medicaid cuts, a presumptive body blow to rural hospitals. There's a lot of people out there that just want to feel like they're doing something because they are so frustrated and upset with the way things are going. Introducing the town hall, the Nebraska Democratic Party chair, Jane Fleming Kleeb, now also a vice chair of the DNC, extolled the advances local Democrats had made since she took the job in 2017. We had 504 Democrats who were elected across the state. We now have 1,027 Democrats who were elected across the state. We're making massive progress, she said cheerfully. She then introduced the evening's featured speaker, Representative Ro Khanna of California, a rising star of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, who co-chaired Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign. Khanna is one of a number of progressive congressional Democrats encouraged by the party to appear in red district town halls in an attempt to rebut impressions that the party is quiescent in the face of Trump's onslaught. As a representative of much of Silicon Valley, the heart of his Northern California district, he stressed that despite the many billionaires among his constituents, he nevertheless won re-election on a platform of taxing the rich. In what sounded at times like a presidential stump speech, Khanna denounced the Republican push to cut taxes for the wealthy as perilous for the deficit and warned of Republicans' threats to Medicaid, mentioning their grievous effect on rural hospitals. He referenced Abraham Lincoln, hailed the generation that won World War II, and stressed the need to understand AI in order to build wealth in the community. Evoking the arrest of the Wisconsin judge, he fervently denounced the administration's assaults on the rule of law. The most patriotic thing in America is standing up for the Constitution, he said, drawing sustained cheers from the crowd. But the audience wanted answers. What, if anything, can the Democratic members of Congress do to get back to the work they should be doing? The power of the purse, checks and balances, setting tariffs, demanded more. I'm curious about what you and your colleagues are doing to stop the funneling of American dollars into a genocide in Palestine, queried a lady at the back of the hall, eliciting loud applause. Another person decried the government's support for Russia instead of Ukraine, prompting somewhat louder applause. A Latino questioner made a heartfelt plea on behalf of undocumented immigrants threatened with deportation to countries they'd left decades ago. A bank employee asked about Trump's evisceration of banking regulations and his promotion of crypto. Though eloquent in detailing the dire effect of Trump's edicts, Khanna had little to offer in the way of immediate solutions. On tariffs, he suggested that Democrats in Congress should seek out and work with Republicans, who suddenly realize how irrational the tariff policy is. He denounced Trump's private crypto ventures while touting Bitcoin as a store of value for young people. Responding to the genocide question, he cited his vote against sending offensive weapons to Netanyahu, while suggesting a chimerical two-state solution for Palestinians as the proper policy goal. Khanna also ventured the occasional jab at his own party's leadership, such as Chuck Schumer's contentious decision to support the Republican continuing budget resolution and the failure of any prominent Democrat to stand with the Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, when they were accused of eating dogs and cats. After the event, I asked Thompson what she thought of Khanna's performance. Some of his answers were better than others, she said, but for her, that wasn't the point of the evening. Really, we wanted to register our discontent with disastrous Trump administration and with our complicit senators and representatives, she said. It also helped to gather with like-minded people for a recharge. Whether the party that had organized the event could harness any of that energy, however, was an open question. The hundreds of thousands of Americans packing into meetings and rallies around the country in the first traumatic months of the year found comfort in the company of others. But for the most part, their hopes for redress lay with the Democratic Party. They may be forlorn indeed, according to a poll concluded in part by the Associated Press in May. Only a third of Democrats feel optimistic about their party's future. The Democratic Party is hollowed out. Tory Cavito, president of Way to Win, a group organizing progressive donors, told me, "It's one of the most vicious cycles I've ever been through. You have Schumer and the old school crew who say, just let the Republicans flame out on their own and we can elect a ham sandwich in the next cycle." She also highlighted efforts to push the anti-regulation, free market, abundance agenda promoted by the New York Times columnist Ezra Klein, which was going great among a class of Silicon Valley donors. Meanwhile, she pointed out, the success of the Fighting Oligarchy rallies has shown that the populist wing of the party is generating enormous energy. "This left-right paradigm only matters to the elites," Cavito said. "It doesn't actually matter to the voters. Everybody's cherry-picking their ideological views. You can have a mom anti-vaxxer still want to have history taught in schools, so ideology is not linear in that way." The scrambling of left and right was clearly demonstrated in Nebraska last year, when the most significant threat faced by Republicans came not from the Democrats, but an independent named Dan Osborne, an industrial mechanic and former union leader who rose to prominence leading the 2021 strike against the cereal giant Kellogg's in Omaha. Osborne ran against a Republican senator, Deb Fischer, on an anti-corporate, pro-worker platform that also called for gun rights, tight border controls, abortion rights, immigration reform, legal marijuana, raising the national minimum wage, and lifting the cap on Social Security contributions. To the alarm of Republicans, he surged in the polls, ultimately coming within less than 7 points of beating Fischer and forcing the party to divert significant cash to shore up support for her. "In my campaign, I never talked about Trump or Harris," Osborne told me. "I talked about education for their kids, about crumbling infrastructure, how Fischer was letting the railroad companies off the hook on safety. I said to people, what do you need?" Strikingly, Osborne outpolled Harris by nearly 20%. "The Democrats are still doing the same thing they did in 2024, he said, "just F Trump." A similar approach paid off in northern Michigan for Betsy Coffia, a former social worker and journalist who flipped a rural statehouse district from red to blue in 2022. Last year, even as Democrats lost control of the Michigan House, she increased her margin of victory and flipped 6 red precincts while making no secret of her support for reproductive rights and gun safety. Like Osborne, she talked about winning over voters by addressing issues they cared about rather than obediently following a script devised by strategists for the Michigan House Democratic Caucus campaign. "I went rogue," she told me over the phone, as she returned to her office from the state capitol. There was a lot of pressure to go with the consultant's one-size-fits-all generic messaging, which was really just hammering abortion rights, she said. Rights that had already been protected in Michigan. I didn't feel like that was what I was hearing and seeing from my constituents. Accordingly, instead of investing money to broadcast the consultant's generic message, she spent it on her own messaging, tailored to the express needs of her district, such as funding for rural busing. "I got into some trouble for doing that," she said, "but I was right." She had no kind words for a national Democratic leadership that was seemingly super focused on winning the 2026 midterms. "I think it's appalling how people are like, this will help us in 2026, when your country's being taken over by an authoritarian bully." The Democratic Party has not been up to the moment, and that's not going unnoticed by a lot of very loyal Democrats in my community. Ken Martin's DNC aims to address some disaffections like Coffia's, as he wrote in a guiding memo in April. "The party will organize early, Organize always, organize everywhere, and win anywhere. The People's Town Halls were evidence of this ground game, as is the money Martin is funneling to state party leadership and away from more consultant-heavy strategies. But instead of presenting a united front, the DNC has since been riven with infighting, sparked by the efforts of David Hogg, the 25-year-old school shooting survivor and progressive activist, to displace incumbents with a younger generation of Democrats while he was serving as vice chair. Klebe, the DNC vice chair, agrees that the party has fallen short. She has seen upsurges of discontent in rural Nebraska before. Part of a ranching and farming family, she fought long and hard against the Keystone XL pipeline, the bitterly contested project to move oil from Canada across the state. When that fight was at its height, she recalled, people had turned out in massive numbers for town halls. They deeply care about protecting their community, whether it's their rural hospital or their water supply. But the Democratic Party had shown little to no interest in local organizing or even showing up. We've lost all this ground in rural communities because we have stopped talking with them, showing up, being in their communities, knowing who the opinion leaders are, because so many of our Dems got old and kind of moved on, and we didn't ever replace them. In Klebe's experience, there had been paltry financial support from national headquarters for local parties across the country. Money at the DNC was diverted to feed an ascendant class of consultants versed in the mysteries of voter analytics. Powerful Democratic donors had diverted funds from party-organized voter registration drives, insisting that this important task be left to nonpartisan outside groups that enjoyed tax-deductible funding. When I first met Klebe in February 2017, she had just taken over Nebraska's Democratic Party. We had both recently been at the DNC meeting in Atlanta, where the party establishment squelched the election of the popular progressive congressman Keith Ellison as party chair in favor of former Libertary Secretary Tom Perez. Former governors and senators, Klebe said, were calling state chairs and officers who had votes and saying, "We really need you to go with Team Perez." Perez did not disappoint his establishment backers, populating key party positions with corporate-friendly consultants and lobbyists. 8 years later, Klebe, now 52, has risen in the party as a close ally of Martin and the head of the Association of State Democratic Committees. At a meeting of Nebraska Young Democrats the day after the Grand Island event, I heard her reminisce about her own beginnings in politics, including organizing programs for the homeless and working with AmeriCorps, another institution Trump has stripped for parts. She recalled how, when she headed the National Young Democrats during the George W. Bush years, activists sported stickers featuring the slogan, "Not my president." That was a symbol of resistance back in the day, she said. Now, simply being anti-Trump isn't enough. I think young people, just like older voters, want to know what the Democrats are going to do. Among other programs she would like to see Democrats adopt, she cited expanding public education to cover pre-K through community college, Medicare for all, making it easier for farmers and ranchers to get insurance, and taking action on climate change. The young Democrats in the room listened attentively, some expressing fears that they faced a more immediate crisis. "If we really meet the moment," murmured a graduate student at the University of Nebraska, "it will bring on martial law." Klebe remained upbeat, giving me an enthusiastic report on the changes Martin was bringing to the DNC. The Republicans had adopted the infamous Project 2025, the far-right agenda being implemented under Trump. So the DNC is constructing a Project 2029 with a principal focus on protecting voting rights, Klebe said. Meanwhile, the DNC has quietly deployed legal teams to prepare for worst-case scenarios, such as Trump interfering with the 2026 elections or attempting to run for a third term in 2028. More immediately, Martin is now pumping money in the direction of the long-neglected state parties. $1 million a month, that's 21% of the DNC budget, Klebe told me, with parties in red states getting extra. Martin has also talked of adopting a holistic approach in which Democrats will wage a perpetual campaign not only in all 50 states, but also in every county and precinct. Martin's principal opponent in the DNC chair race, the Wisconsin Democratic leader Ben Wickler, had secured the energetic support of party establishment heavyweights, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and the tech billionaire and major Democratic donor Reid Hoffman, who reportedly donated $250,000 to Wickler's campaign. But it was the state parties, with which Martin had been working for 8 years, that provided the crucial votes to ensure his convincing victory. His rhetoric skews populist, decrying, for example, candidates on the Democratic side who take money from people who don't share our values. We should only take money from people who share our values, and exclude union-busting corporations and polluters. Among other reforms, Martin has pledged to displace powerful consultants who have long fed off the party. Most of them are going to be gone because they provide absolutely no value or service, he has said. The only thing they care about is lining their own pockets versus winning. That might include those who rose to power back during the Obama and Hillary Clinton eras and who secured major roles in the 2024 race. Harris's campaign chair, Jen O'Malley Dillon, for instance, co-founded her firm, Precision Strategies, after serving as DNC executive director early in Obama's first term. The company waxed rich on Democratic campaigns during Obama's second term and through Trump's first, after which O'Malley Dillon managed Biden's 2020 effort, served as his White House deputy chief of staff, and chaired his 2024 campaign until party leaders belatedly forced him aside. She then stayed on to lead Harris's campaign, in the course of which Precision Strategies garnered handsome rewards from both Harris's operation and the DNC. Gambit Strategies, a firm that received $122 million from the Harris operation, was co-founded by Megan Klassen, a veteran of Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential bid. Bully Pulpit International, recipient of $101 million from Harris, is headed by Andrew Bleeker, formerly lead digital marketing strategist for Obama's 2008 campaign. The most lucrative area for consultants lies in paid media, campaign advertising on TV and online, for which the media and production buying specialists reap commissions. Buying Media and Analytics, owned by the Atlantic firm Canal Partners Media, itself founded by the veteran Georgia Democratic operative Bobby Kahn, took in at least $280 million from the Harris campaign. The concentration of power over party messaging in powerful Washington-based firms evidently contributed to the party's losses among minority groups, whose own interests and concerns often go unreflected in TV spots. The 2024 election saw a fatal erosion of Democratic support among Latino and Black voters. According to Chuck Rocha, a consultant who has focused on the Latino community, by his own count, only 10 out of 250 Democratic consultant firms are Latino or Black majority owned, one of which is his own. All too often, Rocha told me, Spanish language campaign ads were simply translations of generic English language spots as opposed to messages specifically crafted to appeal to Latino communities. Colin Ruggiero, a consultant who worked with the Biden-Harris campaign, later complained that efforts to pitch the candidate to Latino voters fell short because campaign officials debated back and forth about whether or not we should take on these tough issues because we might upset this person or that person. Among those potentially upset by taking on tough issues, such as clear populist messages and criticism of Israel's ongoing massacre in Gaza with American weapons, were those supplying the big money. Mark Cuban, a billionaire Harris donor, hinted that he had gotten a staffer fired for suggesting that Harris supported a tax on unrealized capital gains. Chaim Sabin, the billionaire who forked over $7 million in the early aughts to build a new DNC headquarters in Washington, has expected and certainly received satisfactory Democratic policies on Israel, as reflected in the party's adamant refusal to allow a Palestinian American to speak at its 2024 convention, and the continuing support by a majority of congressional Democrats for arming Israel's onslaught. Not coincidentally, Democratic congressional candidates received the bulk of AIPAC funding in 2024, 58.6%, as opposed to the 38.5% allotted to Republicans. Whatever his intentions, the party machinery inherited by Martin will be difficult to reform. James Zogby, a member of the DNC for the past 32 years, who spent 16 of them on its executive committee, applauds Martin's strategy as a needed shift in resources from the National Party, where money largely went to consultants. But Zogby, who once told me his mission is to be a pain in the ass for the DNC, also provided stark insights into the inner workings of the institution. "Think the Bulgarian Communist Party circa 1955, he said sourly, describing a tightly controlled, top-down structure. There has never been a discussion about budget or priorities. It's an opaque process that is run by consultants and law firms, and the party members are kind of props. We go to meetings and sit there to look like there's actually a decision-making process, but there's not. Ordinary members," he said, "do not have opportunities to ask questions at the biannual meetings, nor could they easily introduce resolutions. Even the executive committee's more frequent meetings haven't featured much or any general discussion." On a conference call with DNC members the weekend after Biden's catastrophic debate with Trump, then DNC Chair Jamie Harrison reportedly turned off the chat function and refused to take questions. Martin may aspire to refashion the party's worldview, but he is confronting decades-old inertia that may well be impossible to overcome. "They still have a model of victory that's based on the Obama coalition," said Zogby, "but there's no Obama in the picture." He recalled an executive committee meeting in the wake of the 2014 midterm elections, which had brought massive Republican gains. The party pollster came in and said, "We did well, even though we lost. We kept our coalition together. We won the black vote, the Latino vote, the youth vote. We just didn't win enough of them. So we've got to put more resources into it." Mindful of white working class voters who had defected to the Republicans in large numbers, Zogby had spoken up. "We've been losing ground in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan, and as a result, those states are going to be passing anti-union, anti-women laws, and it's going to affect everybody," he remembered saying. And the pollster shot back at me and said, "We're not going to be throwing money away, wasting it on people who aren't going to vote for us." This attitude was further articulated by Schumer in July 2016, at a time when Trump's appeal to working class resentments was drawing massive crowds. "For every blue-collar Democrat we will lose in Western PA, we will pick up 2-3 moderate Republicans in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and you can repeat that in Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin." You are listening to the report, "Plain Dead, Do the Democrats Really Want Reform?" from the August 2025 issue of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. After 3 elections and a further withering of Democratic support among blue-collar communities, as well as among Black and Latino voters, Schumer appears to remain confident that Trump, embarking on his malign assault on the constitutional order, will ensure future Democratic success. James Carville reiterated the same point in the New York Times opinion section this past February, suggesting that it's time for Democrats to roll over and play dead. Allow the Republicans to crumble beneath their own weight and make the American people miss us. Zogby described a Schumer address to the DNC early this year, laying out the Democrats' strategy to keep bringing Trump's numbers down so that when it got into the low 40s, they would be able to win control of Congress. Even with party popularity trending at subterranean levels, there is scant indication that elected Democrats in Washington are deviating from business as usual. Schumer opted to support the Republican continuing resolution after saying he wouldn't. A number of Democratic senators have voted on a consistent basis for Trump's cabinet nominees. Senator John Hickenlooper of Colorado, who voted for 10 of them, explained that to do otherwise might piss people off. Senator Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan, a party establishment favorite who trumpets her service in the CIA and talks a lot about deploying Alpha Energy, reverently invoked Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush in the party's official response to Trump's address to Congress in March. Deriding Sanders' rallying cry to fight oligarchy on the grounds that those outside elite institutions may not know what it means, Slotkin has advised Democrats to say they oppose kings instead. "I think the American people are not quite as dumb as Ms. Slotkin thinks they are," responded Sanders. Despite growing outrage at the cruelties of Trump's deportation program, Hakeem Jeffries had reportedly sought to discourage congressional Democrats from journeying to El Salvador in solidarity with illegally imprisoned Kilmer Abrego Garcia, though he has denied it. 12 Democratic senators and 48 House members voted for the xenophobic, Republican-sponsored Laken Riley Act, which enables the deportation of undocumented immigrants merely accused of assorted offenses and gives individual states standing to sue the federal government for enacting immigration policies they do not like. Despite the huge and enthusiastic crowds cheering on Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez at their rallies, many Democrats are still focused on squashing threats from the left. You have to look at the Democratic Party as an army that has been fighting a counterinsurgency campaign against guerrillas, who are the leftists, and progressives calling for justice, equity, health care for all, said Robert Salim Holbrook, a black progressive activist in Philadelphia. "They know how to fight the left, but they don't know how to fight Trump." History indicates that the prime imperative of party organizations is to maintain control over the party, and thus they are most energized by threats to their control by insurgents. But establishment counterinsurgency campaigns are not necessarily successful. After all, it was the attempt by Republican leaders to control the Tea Party uprising that ultimately spawned MAGA and Trump's total dominance of the GOP. In May, the DNC's Credentials Committee recommended that Hogg's election be voided on account of a procedural challenge requiring him to rerun his race. Hogg had aroused fury both inside the DNC and among other Democratic authorities with an initiative to raise money for his own outside group to mount primary challenges against deadweight incumbent Democratic members of Congress. In response, Carville dismissed him as a contemptible little twerp. Hogg remained unrepentant. "He told me that he is fighting for generational change and recruiting candidates who will take on such entrenched interests as Big Oil and the National Rifle Association. The DNC has pledged to remove me, and this vote has provided an avenue to fast-track that effort," he announced after the committee vote. Hogg ultimately opted not to run for re-election as vice chair, announcing that he would continue to challenge the culture of seniority politics that brought our party to this place, from outside the DNC. Interested to hear more from the much-abused congressional leadership, I consulted a senior Senate Democratic staffer with a keen appreciation of battleground races who agreed to speak on background. In contrast to the Jeremiads I heard from Zogby and others, his outlook was upbeat. "I don't think we need wholesale change in the Democratic Party," he told me. In his view, 2024 was an extremely close election. Harris was handed the hardest thing to do in politics. She just had to run so hard, he said, giving voice to the view that Harris could have done better had she had more time, despite the fact that her initial lead over Trump evaporated during the final 3 weeks of the campaign. The staffer had no patience for the notion that a candidate with more populist appeal would have fared better. Some of my Democratic friends love to say, if you just get way out there on progressive issues, there's a bunch of people in the rural areas that are going to come your way, or in the suburban areas that are going to come your way. And I just have never seen that. Instead, he insisted, Democrats should focus on the economy, which is only going to get worse, thanks to Trump's disastrous policies, which will inevitably raise prices and cost jobs. The party's hopes and attention, the staffer told me, are intensely focused on Virginia, where the former Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger is running for governor in November. Spanberger trades heavily on her national security credentials as a former CIA employee. She made centrism her calling card, with a fondness for working with Republicans and blaming progressive messaging for Democratic defeats. Her rhetoric in the current campaign indicates little promise of causing serious offense to corporate interests, which will be reassured by her pledge to refuse to sign any bill repealing the state's anti-union right-to-work law. In the view of the Democratic staffer, she is the ideal candidate, owing to her very strong following, really good grassroots fundraising, good level of support from traditional donors. Spanberger leads in the polls and fundraising, while the Virginia Republicans are riven with internal disputes, so she is likely to win, and popular revulsion over Trump's destructive initiatives may propel the party to wins in the 2026 midterms. But such victories will likely reassure party elders resistant to change, thereby leaving in place the same party that fought and lost the 2024 election, complete with its attachment to Israel and military spending. Despite the reforms instigated by Martin to buttress local organizers like Klebe and the populist energy revealed by the Sanders and Indivisible mass meetings, party strategy will still probably be centered on the rallying cry of F Trump, which failed to secure victory in 2024. In the absence of an audit of the defeat, though Martin has promised one, a consensus has emerged that the fault lies entirely with Biden and his clique for having selfishly insisted on running despite his evident senility. That explanation has the merit of letting everyone else off the hook, but the grim roster should include the vacuous Harris, the inept and avaricious consultants, the endorsement of the Gaza genocide that alienated a significant number of young voters, and the lack of any convincing communication of what the party stands for. Meanwhile, the bulk of Americans struggle with mounting debt, deficient health care, crumbling infrastructure, and decaying public services and education. Martin may pledge to energize the grassroots with support for state and local parties, but those with long memories may recall that the former DNC chair Howard Dean promised a similar effort in the early aughts, only to see it wither within a few short years. It would certainly be noble if the party were to reject cash from those who don't share our values, but might that include Blackstone, the private equity giant previously active, for example, in fighting rent control initiatives and mass evicting tenants? The company was Schumer's leading contributor from 2019 through 2024. Or APAC, whose interventions in Democratic Party campaigns to defeat incumbents have far exceeded the wildest dreams of David Hogg? Martin may be funneling extra funds to state parties, but what happens to them there is another matter. Rocha complained to me that the same consultants who harvested the bulk of the $2 billion spent by the Harris campaign are now working for leading Democratic candidates in the 2026 and 2028 races. Back in Nebraska, Klieb's efforts have borne fruit with a massive swing in Omaha, where Democrat John Ewing Jr. defeated a three-term Republican mayor in May. Meanwhile, Osborne is mulling another independent campaign for Senate on a populist platform, this time against the incumbent Ricketts. Osborne told me that he will call out the dominance of wealthy and corporate donors across both parties and refuse to accept any corporate PAC donations. Given that in 2024, he won nearly 20% more votes than Harris with an explicitly anti-corporate platform, and given the Democrats' oft-professed desire to reconnect with the white working class vote, his willingness to take on issues that weigh most heavily on Americans' minds might provide a better lodestar for Democrats than centrist platitudes. For those still striving to understand what it is that those lost voters really want, the truth is out there, sometimes revealed in surprising places. I talked with Margie Omero, a seasoned pollster and veteran of many Democratic races who, in recent months, has been conducting focus groups with working-class voters, most of whom voted for Trump. Despite Democrats' hope and expectation that Trump's economic mismanagement will crater his working-class support, she reports that many voters accept his promise that, although his policies may create pain in the short term, there would be tremendous gain down the road, a golden future. Well, Omero asked then, what's on the other side? What long-term gains might Trump deliver? The focus group's answers were telling indeed. People say things that Trump isn't promising, like universal health care and addressing income inequality, she said. People are filling it in with what they want, what they need. Now, for a change of pace, I'll be reading a piece of fiction titled At the Window by Christopher Urban, from the early spring 2025 special fiction issue of Raritan, a quarterly journal published by Rutgers University that ceased operations this year. Unlike the windows of my childhood that looked out into our backyard, or even the windows in the classrooms of my elementary school, which offered a view of the green fields awaiting the recess hour, I hardly ever glanced out of the windows of my apartment in the city because, looking up from the windows here, one gets the dreadful sense of being looked at. A wistful outward gaze is returned twofold. I suppose it's out of a desire to remain polite, not to seem too voyeuristic regarding the neighbors, the majority of whom I've never met, that I try to uphold this invisible yet binding contract. Rarely do I stand by the windows of the kitchen, looking out through the translucent white curtains that cover them, thin as butterfly wings, to see what lies beyond the glass panels. The stolen glances I've taken recently, there are only two windows in the kitchen, four total in the small apartment, have afforded me a meager view of backyards and other apartment buildings whose windows face right back at me. And yet from a good distance, lying on the couch in the adjoining room, say, I won't hesitate to look out the window. I can see the top half of the windows showing a pale blue sky at the time of this writing, the bottom half revealing the red stucco rooftops of the apartments across the shared yards. Those ostentatious and gaudy facades, like over-decorated birthday cakes, are something I'd rather not see. The real problem with looking out the windows in the city is that one has the stifling feeling of taking on a burden, of seeing too much, in a rear window sort of way. One sees things one shouldn't and would rather quickly forget, but forgetting them isn't always so easy. I don't mean to suggest I've witnessed a murder or anything criminal, then again it's hard to say, but domestic instances of all kinds, fights, accidents, shouting matches, hasty intercourse, that kind of act of seeking defeats the purpose, for me anyway, of casually looking out the window. Growing up in a sedate small town, I would look out windows to see what I knew only too well, to detect little disturbances in the outdoors that might stimulate my imagination and alleviate the inescapable boredom of certain never-ending afternoons. A swallow's flight from the neighbor's dying oak tree, a squirrel balancing precariously on an old telephone wire, the mailman coming by on foot, careful not to step in mother's freshly planted ajuga, a car, the first one of the morning, driving around the quiet cul-de-sac. In short, it was the lack of movement and the over-familiarity that drew me to look out the window in the first place to see what I could see, in the hopes of spotting some uncommon or infrequent occurrence in nature. Look, a hummingbird at the feeder, to break up the everydayness of life. In those Midwestern windows of my childhood, I could apply, as I have trouble doing now in the metropolis, for there's no need really, the powers of my imagination. Back in the classroom during school days long gone by, my attention was inevitably drawn to the subtle changes outside the framed landscape in the glass panes beside the chalkboard. While the teacher wrote a new word I either already knew or didn't care to learn how to spell, my eyes followed the lingering white, wispy trail of a jet plane in the sky, or perhaps a yellow rubber ball tethered to a pole, swaying limply in the mid-morning breeze, awaiting the kinetic energy of small hands to revive it. Not long ago, I peered outside the window into the 4 o'clock sunlight. I knew from opening the window earlier that day that it was much colder out than it looked. To my surprise, nothing looked back at me. Glancing at the sights below, if you could even call them that, only confirmed what I had previously surmised, that there was simply no point in looking out the windows anymore. I could see, as I could not from the couch, all that was going on, which wasn't much. Only that's not totally true. I did see something I hadn't noticed before. Below the window sat 8 air conditioning units, huddled together in the front corner of the backyard. Many apartments in the area, remodeled since I moved into the neighborhood more than a decade ago, now offer central air. 4 units sit in rows of 2, separated by a short, property-dividing red brick wall. From up here, the third floor isn't high, but high enough, they look like cubes in an ice tray. Back on the couch, I rested my head on a colorful pink, green, orange, and purple-striped pillow whose design reminds me of a piece of hard candy. By reducing what I see outside the window to remedial shapes, the view practically transforms itself into an abstract configuration. Blue from the sky, the same color as yesterday's, cut in half by red-orange stucco rooftops with missing tiles. Below that, another rectangle, beige, followed by a white rectangle, which completes the balcony. Superimposed on these rectangles are 2 clear squares for windows. In the background of the scene, the pale blue rectangles on the top and lower left half of the glass plane meet at right angles. That's what I see, and if past experience is any indication, I know it's all I'll remember of the view from this apartment long after I've moved. Squares and rectangles, and the colors orangish red and pale blue. The following morning, I heard the sound of a pebble hitting the glass window over and over again. I stood up to investigate the source of the commotion. Not for a second did I believe there was a spurned lover or long-lost friend below throwing stones at my window to get my attention or anything romantic like that. I figured it was a bird desperate to make a nest, or perhaps a lone wire sprung loose from the rooftop that, with help from the wind, was making its displacement known. But what I saw when I looked out my window that morning was no longer my, which is to say, my landlord's backyard. There was a beautiful field of green grass surrounded by even greener trees, like something out of an impressionist painting. In the middle of this landscape was a woman wearing a black dress with a large yellow flower in her light brown hair. Elegant blue gloves came up almost past her elbows, and instead of a watch, A golden band with a red rose was fastened loosely on her left wrist. In her other hand was a small black paper fan. Beside her sat a little bistro table with a bowl of apples on top, 7 green, 3 red. She saw me at the window and waved the fan in my direction, beckoning for me to come outside. She had something she wanted to show me, something I needed to see. "I can't," I said, and shrugged. The truth was, I had no way of getting down from here. We weren't supposed to leave our building. I was about to ask her what she was doing outside herself when she suddenly said, "Here," and expertly tossed her long, honey-colored hair, which seemed to grow as in a time-lapse movie, up, 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 all the way to where I stood, where it instantly stuck fast to the window's ledge. I touched the hair, which was smooth and soft, and not sticky as I thought it might be. "No way," I said, looking down at her again. "Don't be afraid. It's not that. If I use your hair to climb down from my apartment, you'll never forgive me, whatever pain or headache that follows my descent." "Oh, shut up," she said, cutting me off. "If that's what you think, I'll climb up my own damn hair." Immediately, I took a step back from the window and glanced around the dim apartment. I raced to the other room, tossed the pillows to the corners of the couch, flipped the light switch on, shelved some books into a bookcase that had fallen into disarray, gathered the dirty dishes and placed them in the sink, and struck a match to burn a squat, lavender-scented candle that had gathered dust on top of the microwave. When I looked back at the window, there was no sign of the woman's hair at all. My stomach dropped a little, and I walked slowly to the edge of the kitchen, hoping she hadn't fallen. But when I peered out into the yard, the landscape had changed once again. Everything was white from a recent snowfall. In the middle of the otherwise silent and empty yard was a large Christmas tree, colorfully decorated and lit up with bright lights. It seemed that all this time I spent by myself, staying at home, not seeing anyone else physically, had overloaded my imagination. The images I'd been harboring on the couch, keeping to myself, sometimes not even jotting them down, had started to overflow and overtake me. All that I hoped to achieve with writing, next to what I was then experiencing through the illusionary powers of my once dormant, now dangerously active mind, I lay down flat on my back on the couch and fell asleep, or tried to. "What's your greatest fear?" said the woman from the garden in a whisper. Her voice was soft in my ear. We were both standing outside now, although where exactly, I couldn't say. It seemed as though the snow had melted from the rain, but now it was no longer raining either. I thought about my answer for a moment. Too long, it turned out, for she replied on my behalf with that characteristic impatience of hers. "Oh, come on, it's the same for everyone," she said, trying to give me a hint. I was still racking my brain for a reply when she uttered, "Death." With her promise to banish that fear from me, I followed her through a thick forest. She was no longer wearing clothes fit for a funeral. Her once black dress became an impossible shade of blue, and a long yellow scarf adorned her neck. 2 pearl bracelets jangled as she walked. We trekked over a hard dirt path of the woods, the sunny sky peeking in here and there between the limbs of the trees as if checking up on us. The blueness of her brilliant dress, a swirled cotton candy pattern, hypnotized me as it shimmered in the gentle breeze. When we finally came to a clearing, I could see mountains in the distance and a large valley with an immaculate body of clear water standing just at the foot of the vast range. On the other side of the woods, a small house caught my eye. After a moment of failed recognition, I placed the home finally as the same orange brick house I grew up in, where I spent more than 2 decades of my life. "Come with me to the Crystal Lake," said the woman in a pseudo-mysterious voice. She seemed a little self-conscious of her abilities and was trying to make light of them with jokes. But having been stuck inside for so long, I felt fatigue settling in. I wasn't sure I could make it much farther. I was too tired and doubted that what strength I had would be sufficient to climb all the way down into the valley, which looked as steep as a crater. Even if I made it, how would I get back up? I preferred the view of the water from up here, I told my guide, who I hoped would understand. I also explained my desire to visit the little two-story house at the edge of the woods. Forget about the house. Trust me, you're going to want to swim in this water. She repeated her line again. Come with me to the Crystal Lake. I think, I said, hesitating before I decided once and for all. I'm good. You're making a huge mistake. The woman sighed and brushed her hair back over her forehead. You ever heard of the Fountain of Youth? She suddenly said, changing her tone of voice. You might want to follow me. I'm trying to help you. She laughed, a most frightening laugh that sent a flock of birds adorning a nearby tree soaring into the air. I smiled and started following her again, but I couldn't shake the feeling that something was off. Suddenly I stopped. I wanted to know what was inside the house and asked her straight up, what's in there? Instead of answering me, she told me what I already knew, that I had aged at an accelerated rate since entering the woods. Her idea was for me to get as close to the edge of the lake as I could, and she'd do her best to push me down if I couldn't make it, and I'd land with a splash in the safety of the water, whose rejuvenating powers would restore whatever broken bones or torn muscles or any ailments, including the negative effects of gravity I was dealing with. She reiterated that it would all be worth it. The whites of her eyes glowed crimson when she said this. I tried picturing myself swimming underwater, feeling magically younger and stronger, but instead all I could see was a vision of a body, mine, tumbling down the jagged and semi-rocky hill before crashing into water that would drown me. I estimated the chances of my survival and said, I wouldn't make it. You're not going to make it anyway. She started toward the lake, expecting me to follow. But instead, I turned and walked toward the house by the woods. I felt my strength gathering, even as it became harder to breathe. Perhaps I only imagined it. I can't be sure. But I saw, sitting there on the wooden bench in the family room of my old childhood home, my younger self looking out at me, taking notes on an impenetrable story about opaque windows. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode of Harper's Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's readings have been from the August 2025 issue. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying goodbye for now and hoping that you'll join me again next time.